thinks. We'll also look at how the media helped and hindered the Welcome to Country debate.
That's in 30 minutes on ABC Radio National with me, Tim Burrows.
And me, Vivian Kelly. Catch you then.
ABC News, I'm Thanmaya Navada. Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton have spent the final full day of the election campaign traversing the country and making last-minute pitches to undecided voters. Alison Schauer reports from Parliament House.
After a frenetic 5 weeks, the Prime Minister and opposition leader have kept up the pace today. Mr Albanese began the day at an urgent care clinic in Brisbane and also visited Peter Dutton's own seat of Dixon before travelling to Tasmania.
The coalition have cuts and chaos.
Mr Dutton began the day in Adelaide and then flew to Perth, where he emphasised cost of living pressures on households and small businesses.
And Australians can't afford 3 more years of labour.
Nearly 8 million Australians have already cast their ballots ahead of polling day tomorrow.
Researchers say Chinese influencers are being used to spruik political messages during the federal election campaign. Some candidates have been using third parties to advertise on Chinese platforms such as WeChat and Redbook. Dr. Fan Yang from the University of Melbourne's Law School says it could blur the lines of disclosed campaigning and could also be leading to the spread of misinformation.
Some third-party advertising agencies can outsource this work to a China-based marketing agency that obtain connections with Chinese celebrities. Those celebrities, they might have very little understanding about Australian politics and also those candidates.
The Victorian Supreme Court has heard accused triple murderer Erin Patterson didn't ask about the condition of her sick in-laws after her deadly mushroom lunch. Jared Whittaker reports from Morville.
Erin Patterson's estranged husband Simon told the Supreme Court that he was intrigued when his wife did not ask about the welfare of her guests. Under cross-examination, Mr. Patterson said she didn't actually ask how sick they were. Ms. Patterson served a beef Wellington lunch at her Leongatha home in July 2023 that left 3 relatives dead and another seriously injured. Prosecutors allege she hosted the lunch to tell her guests she had cancer, a claim her lawyers admit was fake, before deliberately poisoning her relatives. Ms. Patterson has pleaded not guilty and says the deaths were a tragic accident. The trial resumes on Monday.
Emergency crews have described the tricky conditions they faced while rescuing survivors of a helicopter crash in Melbourne's southwest this morning. 3 people were travelling in a Robinson R-44 helicopter when the engine failed, plunging them into shallow waters near Point Lonsdale in Victoria's Bellarine Peninsula just after 10 o'clock this morning. 2 men in their 50s and a woman in her 40s are in a serious but stable condition. Firefighter Matthew Kneebone was one of the first on scene and says it was a difficult mission for emergency crews to reach them.
Between Ocean Grove and Lonnie, there's not much in between, just sand dunes. Climbing over and getting to them. And then the tricky part, I suppose, was logistically arranging for the support needed with AV getting on the beach, so their vehicle's not four-wheel drive.
Overseas, a group of pro-Palestinian activists say their ship has been struck by drone fire in international waters off the coast of Malta. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition says its passenger ship Conscience was 13 nautical miles east of Malta when it was struck twice in the bow. The group says there are 30 activists on board and they haven't heard from them for several hours. 4 Australian activists were preparing to board the ship in Malta and journey to Gaza, which remains under an Israeli blockade, with food, medical supplies and others. The Israeli Defence Forces is yet to comment. South Korea's Han Duck-soo has announced his presidential bid a day after resigning as acting president and prime minister. Chelsea Hetherington reports.
Mr. Han has made the announcement in Seoul at the South Korean National Assembly. He says if elected, his top priority would be to lessen the powers of the office and ease strife-ridden domestic politics. South Korea is holding a snap election on the 3rd of June after President Yoon Sung-yeol was ousted over his imposition of martial law. Mr. Han was appointed prime minister under Mr. Yoon and then served as acting leader. The 75-year-old will team up with the People Power Party to launch a unified conservative campaign against Liberal frontrunner Lee Jae-myung. Education Minister Lee Joo-ho will step in as acting president.
US President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that aims to cut funding to news outlets NPR and PBS. The court instructs the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to cease direct funding to them. It labels the news outlets as partisan and biased. You're listening to ABC News.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, on election eve, the leaders visit as many seats as possible to make their final pitch to voters. Some pundits say a hung parliament is likely, while others aren't ruling out clear wins for either side. And the US President Donald Trump dumps his national security adviser after his embarrassing Signalgate blunder.
There does seem some indication that he wasn't sufficiently obsequious in terms of the president himself. It is just one indication of an overall foreign policy and national security team that seems to be in a bit of chaos right now.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, have spent the final full day of their campaigns traversing the country, visiting must-win seats and making last-minute pitches to undecided voters. Mr Dutton says he remains confident the coalition can win the election, despite polls indicating a narrow Labor victory, while Mr Albanese maintains he still has a mountain to climb to get his government re-elected. Gavin Coote begins our coverage.
It was an early start for the opposition leader Peter Dutton, kicking off his final full day of campaigning at a produce market in Adelaide, where both he and the market workers were gearing up for a big day.
Busy morning.
Busy morning, yeah. Busy. Lack of sleep.
Coffee help?
Yeah, 15 coffees so far.
Sorry, had a busy day.
The Liberal leader also sampled some fruit juice while preparing for his final sprint.
Cheers, bud.
Well done.
Cheers.
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 He then headed west, visiting a campervan business in Perth, in Tangney, Labor's most marginal WA seat. Projecting confidence despite most polls showing him trailing Labor, Peter Dutton declared he was still in a position to win.
We've worked hard every day and night. I've been excited to go around the country and meet Australians from every corner of this amazing, amazing country. These people have told us their stories. Young families and pensioners and others who are suffering under this government, and 25 cents a litre cut in fuel, and that's going to provide huge support straight away. $1,200 back of your own tax, that's going to provide big support, and we're going to fix up the economy so we can bring inflation down, and we're going to make sure that we can keep our country safe and improve safety in our suburbs and communities. And on that basis, there's no doubt in my mind that we can be successful at the election.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has also been crisscrossing the country today, making an early stop in Peter Dutton's seat of Dixon in Brisbane before heading to Devonport in Tasmania's north. The city is in the Liberal-held seat of Braddon, where Labor is hoping to take advantage of the fact that the sitting member is retiring.
Oh, happy birthday! How are you going?
With his deputy, Richard Miles, accompanying him at a local bakery, Mr Albanese was making a last-minute pitch to Tasmanians for a second Labor term.
This is a community that need a Labor government. There's a lot of working-class people here, and they know that issues like same job, same pay, real wage increases make a difference. The other mob will get rid of those changes, the right to disconnect, the changes to casualisation that occur. Working people and people in this electorate need a Labor government.
Another party which sees fertile ground in hip-pocket issues is the Greens, which won an extra three lower house seats in the 2022 election and has been campaigning hard on the issue of housing. While Labor has ruled out any deals with the Greens in the event of a hung parliament, the minor party is talking up its potential influence in the next government. Greens leader Adam Bandt says support for the major parties is dropping, and he expects that trend to continue.
I would be astounded if the Prime Minister or anyone else refused to respect the will of the Australian people. Like, at the moment, less than one in three people vote for the government, a bit more than one in three vote for the opposition, and one in three people in this country is now voting for someone else, including the Greens.
Another unknown factor is whether the Teal Independents will be able to build on their success in the 2022 election, in which they took six seats from the Liberals. One of those seats Peter Dutton hopes his party can win back is Curtin in Perth's affluent western suburbs, where independent Kate Chaney holds it on a margin of 1.3%.
Don't forget that Kate Chaney is working in lockstep with the Labor Party. The Labor Party's running soft in Curtin to support somebody that they know is a fellow traveller. And Kate Chaney would support a Labor Greens government, and that would be bad for WA.
Anthony Albanese, however, remains tight-lipped on whether he'd work with the Teal independents should Labor fall short of a majority.
What I'm intending to do is to see a majority government elected tomorrow.
Zali Steggall was the first Teal independent to be elected to Parliament after unseating former Prime Minister Tony Abbott in 2019. She thinks the popularity of independents has yet to reach its peak.
Australian people are looking for choice, and they've been doing that for quite a few elections now as the primary vote for the major parties keeps dropping. So I don't think the idea that the high vote for independents that occurred at the 2022 election was a blip or a reaction to one leader in particular. I think it's an ongoing trend.
While today's frenetic efforts have been aimed at voters who've yet to make a decision, more than 7 million Australians have already cast their ballots.
Gavin Koosh reporting. So, as Gavin just mentioned, a lot of people have already cast their ballots, while others are still deciding who they're going to vote for tomorrow. Across the country, the ABC has been asking people how they're making their choice. Rachel Hayter prepared this report.
How you going, fellas?
Come on.
Can we just see one of these?
Oh, I can't be bothered carrying.
That's fair enough.
Labor currently holds the leafy electorate of Chisholm in Melbourne's east with a 3.3% margin. Cost of living is once again high on voters' agendas.
The cost of living is really tough. I'm not politically affiliated in any way, so I read through some of the kind of policies around cost of living and went, OK, I might lean this way rather than the other. But nothing really stood out to me this year that sort of made me go, oh, things are going to get better.
After many years of voting, it's just hard to know who to believe. Policies are promises that are often broken.
Primarily the cost of living, probably also entry into the housing market.
Certainly the tax issues because of the cost of living, particularly land tax, is hurting a lot of people.
Independents swept Melbourne's east at the last federal election in the neighbouring seats of Kooyong and Goldstein, and a potential minority government is on voters' minds this time around.
It's a dangerous thing, I think, and I don't know a great deal about politics, but I think it just, there's a grey area, so whether a policy can come through that would benefit the public, I don't know. So a minority would be a concern.
All over the country, there are voters still trying to work out who they should vote for. Campbelltown is in Tasmania's Midlands and is part of the state's largest electorate of Lions. And this woman remains undecided.
I have never felt so conflicted going to the polls. I feel like every year there's lots of promises and there's no execution. I feel like no one really has any power to enact or do anything that is required.
Ken is from Campbelltown too. He's a rusted-on voter who, like more than 7 million other Australians, has already had his say.
I'm a Labor man, always been a Labor man. So I always vote early, I know who I'm voting for, and I don't ever worry about all the freebies or all the promises.
There are rusted-on Conservatives too. Strathpine is on the northern outskirts of Brisbane and sits in Peter Dutton's seat of Dixon.
What I've seen over the last few years, Liberals have got a better idea. They may not have the best person there, but they've got better ideas.
Up in Darwin, Ian says the Coalition's policy to halve the tax on fuel for 12 months is a winner.
Dutton's on the right place for immediate relief in the fuel thing. That's a big thing for transport, which should cut down the costs in places like Central Australia.
This woman is worried about crime.
I live in a pretty rough part of Darwin. So, yeah, the crime in Darwin's just getting out of control.
In Western Australia's most marginal seat of Moore on Perth's northern beaches, this young voter has been swayed to vote Greens after listening to a popular podcast.
Abby Chatfield interviewed a few people. That was really interesting and insightful. So it's all very new to me, and learning about it all is very new to me. Liberal protects people who already have foundation, whereas Greens and Labor are looking out for the people for the future.
And this man has a suggestion about how to improve political engagement.
If you vote, you get like a pint at the pub or something. I reckon that would work.
That would get me in to vote, that's for sure.
Ben Rowey is an electoral analyst and founder of The Tally Room. He says the latest polling indicates a Labor victory tomorrow.
So we saw a YouGov MRP yesterday. Those are those giant polls where they try and predict the outcomes of seats, and they actually had Labor gaining about 7 seats and also a bigger crossbench. So that would put the coalition at their lowest level of seat count in Parliament, like basically since the Liberal Party was founded in the 1940s.
Both leaders have regularly visited the West this campaign, and Ben Rowey believes Western Australia could shape up to be a key battleground tomorrow.
We kind of expected WA to kind of fall back to earth a little bit and the Liberal Party to recover. And the state polls are really showing that's not happening, that Labor is really holding the ground in WA.
His final prediction is a minority government to Labor, or Anthony Albanese holding on to his majority.
If Labor wins big, they will still get a majority. It's certainly possible. There's a good chance it will happen. But if the election is at all close, it'll be a hung parliament. But the exact numbers will really decide that.
That's electoral analyst Ben Rowey. That report from Rachel Hayter and Kimberly Price. Karen Middleton is a political journalist and columnist for Inside Story. She told me it's hard to tip the result of this election.
I think still the best guess is a Labor minority government, but I think a majority returned Labor government is possible, and there's an outside chance of a Liberal minority government as well. But I think it's a very hard path for the Liberals to win enough seats to be in the contest for minority government. But there are so many seats that are on a knife edge and people aren't willing to call one way or the other. You can't really rule much out.
As we know, the polls seem to have been moving in Labor's favour during the campaigns. But do you think the government could suffer a backlash because of the cost of living crisis that just isn't being picked up in the polls?
Oh, definitely. I mean, people are very angry and upset at the cost of living and the state of their own financial circumstances. And that's why we saw the Labor government take a hit in the opinion polls through, you know, over the past year. And it's really only been recovering in these last weeks. So that tells you that people are unhappy. Maybe it also tells you that they're looking at the alternative and then they're weighing up whether the alternative would be better or not. What people are saying is that, in terms of strategists, are saying that you've got to be very careful about looking at the published two-party poll results, that while the trend is certainly all suggesting things have moved back in Labor's favour, they may not be reflecting things on the ground in key seats, because they may, for example, show a swing back to Labor in seats that they already hold, which doesn't make much difference. It's the seats that are marginal, the seats that they might lose, the ones that they need to win, where it's very important. And so I think there may be differences on the ground, seat by seat, according to how well-known candidates are and the mood and issues in individual seats that could make the difference to how much of a backlash there is.
I'll ask you for your thoughts on a couple of seats in a moment, but what's your assessment of the respective campaigns?
I think Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, has done a lot better than he did last time, like a lot better, probably surprisingly better. And equally surprisingly, if not more surprisingly, is that the opposition's campaign has been really a little bit of a mess. I think we expected a lot better from them. Historically, the coalition, particularly the Liberals, have run very good campaigns. And this time it just seemed to be a bit all over the place with policy flip-flops and mistakes from the leader, Peter Dutton. And I think generally they have squandered the lead that they had by not being effective campaigners and perhaps contributing to that hesitation that people might feel when they go to the polling booth and they say, well, am I ready to kick out the incumbent and give the other lot a go?
Why do you think the campaign has been a bit disappointing for many coalition supporters?
I think there wasn't enough work done on policy early enough, and I think Peter Dutton not only didn't design the policy early enough, but wasn't out there explaining policy early enough, which meant that there was a lot of explaining and designing to be done at the last minute. And what you want in a campaign is to have seeded the idea about yourself and your party and what you stand for, and then be reinforcing it with smaller announcements, sometimes with big announcements, but announcements that reinforce the existing idea of what you stand for. And sticking to those clear messages, particularly on the economy. And I think they didn't do enough of that early enough. They've had to scramble to do it during the campaign. And they've been talking about all kinds of different things, which isn't that clean and clear message. And I think they've left some people confused and therefore some people in the coalition a bit disappointed.
There is a real trend, at least at the last couple of polls, for a move away from supporting the two major sides of politics. What are you going to be watching out for in terms of how the independents and the minor parties go?
Well, that's going to be very interesting, both to look at those independents who won seats last time and then to look at a handful of seats where there are independent challengers who could do quite well. Among the ones that won last time, you know, we're told the most vulnerable are Kate Chaney in Curtin in Western Australia, Monique Ryan in Kooyong in Melbourne, and maybe Zoe Daniel in Goldstein, also in Melbourne. But, you know, history shows us that when independents win a seat at a general election, they're very often, they become entrenched. It's, you know, they don't often get turfed out again at the next election. If they win at a by-election, that's different. So there is that history on their side, that precedent. So we'll see whether there's enough antipathy to individual candidates or unhappiness about performance or the state of the economy that sees people go back to a major party in those seats. And then there are some other seats where there are independents that are potentially shaking things up, like the seat of Warnan in regional Victoria, where Dan Tehan, the former minister, now shadow immigration minister, has a challenge from Alex Dyson, independent former Triple J host, who's had three, this will be a third crack there.
And Karen, what about the minor parties, the Greens? And there's a bit of talk about sort of Pauline Hanson's party up against Clive Palmer's Trumpet of Patriots.
I think the Greens are interesting because they were so surprisingly successful at the last election. They won three seats in Queensland. Everyone's suggesting they're struggling to hold those. Pauline Hanson and the Trumpet of Patriots are interesting because there are quite a number of more right-leaning, smaller parties in the mix this time around, and there's a suggestion that they may be harvesting some of the anger that arose out of the COVID lockdowns, particularly in Victoria. I think Trumpet of Patriots, Clive Palmer, is obviously spending an enormous amount of money. I don't know of anyone who expects him to win a seat as a result. It's more likely that preferences will influence results in certain seats. And with Pauline Hanson doing the preference deal with the Liberal Party, again, she's not likely to win lower house seats, but her preferences or the recommendations, and that's how it works, she prints a how-to-vote card and she recommends to her supporters that they vote a particular way. If they follow that card, those preferences could help the Liberals win in some seats. But where she hopes to get the benefit of Liberal Party voters preferencing her is in the Senate, and she's a show to win more seats in the Senate, possibly including Jackie Lambie's seat in Tasmania.
Is there a particular state or states that will really dictate the outcome?
Well, the really, really key state is Victoria, because we know there's anger at the state Labor government and that both major parties federally say that that is carrying over to a loss of support for federal Labor. But how strong that loss of support is on by tomorrow night and how bad it turns out to be for Labor is an open question. But there are a lot of seats in play in Victoria, and New South Wales is the other really big one. Big swings in either New South Wales or Victoria towards the coalition could be problematic for Labor. But again, you know, there are so many seats finely balanced, and this election is so much about issues in individual seats and on the ground, that it's really very difficult to tell which way seats are going to go. And, I mean, we could have a really decisive result one way or the other if all those seats go in the same direction. But the suggestion is they're not going to, and the most likely outcome is that a whole lot of seats change hands, but the results could still be quite tight.
That's Karen Middleton, a political journalist and columnist for Inside Story. And for live election results on Saturday night, do tune in to ABC Local Radio, News Radio or Radio National for special coverage with Sabra Lane, Thomas Ariti and Melissa Clark. That's from 6 p.m. East Coast time. You can also get election updates on the ABC Listen app. And AM will bring you all results in a special edition on Sunday morning, right after the 8 o'clock news. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Well, overseas now, and what's being viewed as the first major shake-up of his inner circle since he took office in January, Donald Trump is dumping his national security adviser, Mike Waltz. He's not leaving in disgrace, though. The president is nominating him to be the new US ambassador to the United Nations. The move comes just weeks after it emerged Mr. Waltz had added a journalist to a group chat on the messaging app Signal, giving him access to sensitive military plans. For more on this, I spoke to Professor Gordon Flake, the CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia. Professor Flake, why do you think President Trump has moved Mike Waltz out of this role?
A lot of speculation in a situation that is still pretty opaque in terms of the individual relationships there. On the face of it, obviously, his involvement in the Signal chat scandal is part of that. There does seem some indication that he wasn't sufficiently obsequient in terms of the president himself, and that he was pushing the president on too many things, and that was the cause for moving it on. But again, I'm not sure that anybody knows for sure. It is just one indication of an overall foreign policy and national security team that seems to be in a bit of chaos right now. The initial chattering class response was, why Mike Waltz and not Pete Hegseth, right? Because if there was a real fault to be had in the Signal chat scandal, it would have been the Secretary of Defense, not the National Security Advisor.
Yes, I wanted to get to Pete Hegseth, but you've got to him early. Just explain for us the roles the two men have played in this so-called Signal Gate drama.
The fundamental initial step that was a mistake was the adding of a reporter, one of the editor of The Atlantic, to a Signal chat. That was done by Mike Waltz, you know, the national security advisor to the president. So there's a step one mistake here, that these conversations shouldn't have been happening on Signal anyway. So even the establishment or the building of a chat group itself was a violation of not just of protocol, but national security information handling laws and rules. And one of the real underlying issues for that, of course, is that it not only is at risk of being intercepted by hostile foreign intelligence communities, it's not secure, but more importantly, it's not preserved. It's not open. It's not transparent. And so there's no record for history or for legal proceedings. You know, the Signal chats just go away. And that's probably why they decided to use it, not just out of being irresponsible. So the setting up of the chat and the adding of the reporter from The Atlantic, that blame clearly fell on the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz. And so you could argue that he's taking the fall for that. The sharing of what is by all accounts classified information about military strikes on Yemen, that was done by the Secretary of Defense, by Pete Hegseth. And again, it's added to what has now been kind of an emerging three-week series of scandals about the practices of the Secretary of Defense. But the truth is, everyone involved on that chat was violating protocol, and more than protocol, probably violating the law in terms of how classified information should be handled. And it was all done to avoid transparency.
So you said that the word is possibly that Mike Waltz wasn't as obsequious to Trump. Do we read into that, if Pete Hegseth has survived, that he's a little bit more of a sycophant when it comes to his dealings with the president?
Well, shortly after the election in November, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., said very openly that the most important qualification for anybody being nominated to the Trump cabinet would be that they did not think that they knew more than the president. And as we've seen just in the last 24 hours by these North Korea-style remarkable cabinet meetings with cabinet officers sitting in front of red MAGA hats and one by one by one taking their turns praising the dear leader in just over-the-top terms, that is a fundamental requirement to serving in the Trump cabinet. And there is a certain element of loyalty that you've seen now from the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. I am not aware of any specific areas in which Mike Waltz differed with the president. I just read, you know, some early reports that suggest that one of the reasons he was moved off was that he wasn't sufficiently a yes man for the president.
So the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is now going to serve as the interim national security advisor, and he's got another couple of roles, I think, the acting administrator of the US Agency for International Development and some role too with the National Archives. Is it wise to have someone wearing so many hats?
No, it certainly isn't, and it's certainly beyond the capability of any one man in this day and age. It just is a clear indication that this is not a very deep pool.
Professor Gordon Flake is the CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth and Nick Drakoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. PM will be back on Monday evening. Just a reminder, there'll be full coverage of the election results tomorrow night on ABC Radio and a special edition of AM on Sunday morning. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
ABC Radio National.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Tell me, Viv, how many texts have you had from Clive Palmer this week?
I've got my phone in front of me, Tim, and I can tell you that at time of recording, it's six, which quite frankly is six too many, but I feel like that number could still climb as we talk today.
It is a rapidly evolving situation when it comes to Clive Palmer texts.
But what has been interesting, not the texts, is how the media has covered this issue and the wider federal election campaign.
Before the election, former journalist and now media analyst Dennis Muller threw a challenge to the media to keep the bastards honest. Coming up, we'll find out how he thinks they went. But first, Viv, one of the few flashpoints of what I think has been a relatively tame election campaign has been the focus on the welcome to country issue.
Yes, and it's sort of become this media flashpoint that's become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy where people are talking about it and now journalists can't stop asking about it, which means politicians won't stop talking about it, and then they get asked about it again. There's been a frenzy of media coverage, but Indigenous journalists have asked the media to just stop going on about it.
And I guess the question is whether that's a request that would ever be fulfilled. You know, when a major party is raising an issue during the campaign, there's a pretty strong argument that